Good evening. Good evening. It's great to be here. I am thankful for the opportunity and glad for the reason for the opportunity with little Jillian. And hope and pray that things continue to go well for Teresa and Jillian. And I guess for Louie too. Yeah. All right. Well, it's great to be here. I wanted to share with you some ideas. I must say I am borrowing from some work I did for the lesson series that I'm doing over at Expressway, so I'm getting good use out of that material. Hopefully it'll be good use out of that material. I had talked to you before about one of the concepts related to the idea of looking for the balance that the Bible presents about various issues, finding the biblical balance to truly answer the questions the right way and be able to conduct our lives in a manner that is according to what God would have us to do, looking at how to take all of the scriptures related to a particular issue and make sure that we are not getting off to one extreme or the other. Well, I want to talk to you tonight with that in mind about the Christian's relationship, what our relationship should be with the world. And that actually could take on a number of different applications. I've got a couple of applications in particular that I would like to share with you tonight for us to consider together. And so there are two phases, basically. Here's the first concept. We'll get started with that. If you turn to Matthew 6 and verse 24... Matthew 6 and verse 24. Jesus says, "No one can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will be loyal to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon." And so it says we have to make a choice. We can't straddle the fence and try to go two directions at the same time. We have to make a choice. Now, the implication here is that we need to choose to serve God rather than serve riches or mammon, as it says. But we need to make sure that we are on that side of things to begin with. There's another passage, Romans 12, that helps us to understand that relationship with things of this world as well. Romans 12. Verses 1 and 2. "I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable to God, which is your reasonable service. And do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God." And so we see that we need to make sure that we're not conforming ourselves to this world, but that we are transformed in service to God. The first one refers to this as our reasonable service, what is reasonable, appropriate for us to be doing. So definitely we need to be choosing to serve God rather than having a conformity to the things of the world and a love for riches, those types of things. 1 John chapter 2 and verse 15 and following. "Do not love the world or the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life, is not of the Father, but is of the world. And the world is passing away in the lust of it, but he who does the will of God abides forever." We need to not love the world. We need to be joined to doing the things of the Father. Well, these calls to make a choice to serve God rather than trying to straddle the fence, to not be conformed but be transformed, to not love the world, One of the easiest ways to try to go about that is just to take ourselves out of the world, it would seem. You know, the less we have any involvement at all with the world, then it would be more dedicated to trying to follow these principles, it would seem. And yet, is that really what's being called for? 1 Corinthians 5. When Paul first wrote to the Corinthians, it appears that there was a letter to the Corinthians prior to 1 Corinthians. So maybe we should have just called this one 2 Corinthians without a 1 Corinthians, and then 2 would be 3rd. Well, no. But if you look, there's a reference to writing an epistle previously that we don't have here in the record. 1 Corinthians 5, verse 9. I wrote to you in my epistle not to keep company with sexually immoral people. What was their conclusion from that? Well, he has to modify or readjust their thinking of exactly what he intended by that. He says, yet I certainly did not mean with the sexually immoral people of this world, or with the covetous, or extortioners, or idolaters, since then you would need to go out of the world. And so he makes the point, now wait a minute, you're going off to an extreme if you think I'm saying avoid any contact with anybody who's in the world. That's not what I really meant. Some of these earlier passages might get us to lean that direction, and whatever Paul said in that first letter must have gotten some of the Corinthians to think, okay, well, I've just got to not talk to them, not have any kind of association with them. Well, he goes on to explain, but now I have written to you not to keep company with anyone named a brother who is caught up in these types of sins. Okay? And he's really talking about the fellowship within the church, within the congregation. But he makes a side point that is, well, now wait a minute. If I were asking you, or if I were commanding you not to have any association with any person of the world, then you would have to separate yourselves out. It would be a monastery kind of a circumstance. But that's not what we're called to, okay? And thankfully, we have this passage in order to bring us back from such an extreme, to give us a little bit of perspective that way. Well, look at Luke 19, because this is Jesus showing an example of the relationship with the world that he had, and some things that we might be able to see about this example. Then Jesus, verse 1, then Jesus entered and passed through Jericho. Now behold, there was a man named Zacchaeus, who was a chief tax collector, and he was rich. And he sought to see Jesus, who Jesus was, but could not because of the crowd, for he was a wee little man. That's a paraphrase, I guess. He was of short stature. That just doesn't work as well in a lyric, and so they kind of adjusted it a little bit, I guess. So he ran ahead and climbed up into a sycamore tree to see him, for he was going to pass that way. And when Jesus came to the place, he looked up and saw him and said to him, Zacchaeus, make haste and come down, for today I must stay at your house. So he made haste and came down and received him joyfully. But when they saw it, they all complained, saying, he has gone to be a guest with a man who is a sinner. Then Zacchaeus stood and said to the Lord, look, Lord, I give half of my goods to the poor, and if I have taken anything from anyone by false accusation, I restore fourfold. And Jesus said to him, today salvation has come to this house, because he also is a son of Abraham. For the Son of Man has come to seek and to save that which was lost. Well, what got people bothered here? What got people bothered was the scribes and Pharisees had an attitude of don't have anything to do with anybody who is of the world. And if you look at some of the early passages, Matthew 6, Romans 12, 1 John 2, Well, whatever Paul wrote to them initially, the Corinthians came to a conclusion that maybe that kind of a mindset would have been appropriate to have that level of separation and distinction. But Jesus didn't have that level of separation and distinction. Why? Because Jesus was looking for opportunities to help those and to reach out to those and have enough of a relationship with those in order to seek and to save. Right? And so Jesus was having a relationship with those in the world in order to save. That's what he was there for. We need to look to have relationships in order to be able to seek and to save as well. Okay, well, so I kind of have this set up. Well, there are passages over on this side, and there are passages over on that side. Well, I'm going to put another passage over on this side again. Go to 2 Corinthians 6. If you think about it, 1 Corinthians, he ends up pulling them back from being totally separated and never having any contact with those in the world. Well, 2 Corinthians, which is really the third letter, 6, and verse 14 and following, he says, "Do not be unequally yoked together with unbelievers. For what fellowship has righteousness with lawlessness? And what communion has light with darkness? And what accord has Christ with Belial? Or what part has a believer with an unbeliever? And what agreement has the temple of God with idols? For you are the temple of the living God. As God has said, I will dwell in them and walk among them. I will be their God, and they shall be my people. Therefore, come out from among them and be separate, says the Lord. Do not touch what is unclean, and I will receive you. I will be a father to you, and you shall be my sons and daughters, says the Lord Almighty. Therefore, having these promises, beloved, let us cleanse ourselves from all filthiness of the flesh and spirit, perfecting holiness in the fear of God." Well, which is it? I mean, that sounds a lot more like whatever the first letter probably said, right? As far as that gives us a... Why do you have such a relationship with unbelievers? Come out and be separate. So what is it that we're really called to do? Well, the key is we're not to be in the monastery. We're not to totally separate ourselves out. But who is influencing whom? In this passage here, it's a question of being influenced into whatever that evil would be. And he says, what fellowship do you have with unrighteousness? Why is it that you would get yourself mixed up in unrighteousness? Why would you be unequally yoked where it's something that you can't handle the burden properly? Because you're in a relationship in which the world is influencing you. Jesus wasn't in that relationship. Jesus was in a relationship with the world where he was influencing them, rather than the world being the one that was dominating, influencing us. And so this is a call for us not to get ourselves into worldly relationships such that they are the ones influencing us. That doesn't mean step out of the world and don't have anything to do with it. It means step into relationships with the world in which you can be of help to someone else. So we are to be in the world, but we're not to get caught up in the world. We're not to be conformed to the world such that the world is the dominant influence on us, unequally yoking us and causing us to not be in fellowship with God. Who is influencing whom? One last passage just so we can see and understand how we should be in relationship to worldly things. Psalm 1 describes the person who does live in the world, but is properly established not to be influenced by the things in the world. Blessed is the man who walks not in the counsel of the ungodly, nor stands in the path of sinners, nor sits in the seat of the scornful. But his delight is in the law of the Lord, and in his law he meditates day and night. He shall be like a tree planted by the rivers of water, that brings forth its fruit in its season, whose leaf also shall not wither, and whatever he does shall prosper. The ungodly are not so, but are like the chaff which the wind drives away. Therefore, the ungodly shall not stand in the judgment, nor sinners in the congregation of the righteous. For the Lord knows the way of the righteous, but the way of the ungodly shall perish. There's a definite need to be distinct from worldliness. But Jesus reached out to help those. And Paul explicitly says, it doesn't mean never deal with them. And so we need to find that balance to be in the world, but not of the world. Okay, the other concept that I'd like to talk about, let's start with Matthew 5. How we are to have a proper relationship with the world. Matthew 5, verse 43 through 48. You have heard that it was said, You shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies. I was trying to say love your enemies even earlier than it was showing up here. But I say to you, love your enemies. Bless those who curse you. Do good to those who hate you. And pray for those who spitefully use you and persecute you, that you may be sons of your Father in heaven. For he makes his sun rise on the evil and on the good, and sends rain on the just and on the unjust. For if you love those who love you, what reward have you? Do not even the tax collectors do the same? And if you greet your brethren only, what do you do more than others? Do not even the tax collectors do so? Therefore you shall be perfect just as your Father in heaven is perfect. We're supposed to love our enemies. We're supposed to bless them. We're supposed to do good and pray for them. And seek what is in their best interest. The love concept is really seek what is in their best interest. Well, let's couple with that the idea in Matthew 28. Matthew 28, verses 18 through 20. And Jesus came and spoke to them, saying, all authority has been given to me in heaven and on earth. Go, therefore, and make disciples of all the nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe all things that I have commanded you. And lo, I am with you always, even to the end of the age. One of the main things that we're called on, and if you look at 2 Timothy 2:2, you see that faithful men were to teach faithful men in order to be able to teach faithful men and perpetuate the gospel by people teaching people teaching people, right? And so we're called on to spread the gospel, to make disciples. One of the ways of seeking the best interest of our enemies is to share with them the gospel. That's in their best interest for them to learn. And to try to help them, even though they're very difficult to work with, right? Well, so if someone is being difficult to work with and you're trying to be a good influence, working in the world, trying to influence that person for good, and you feel an obligation to try to help them understand the Bible and say appropriate things from the Bible to try to get them. But that really brings on only more and more difficulty and strife because they are not receptive to it. what is our obligation to continue to teach and continue to teach and continue to teach? Well, within the Sermon on the Mount, there is another passage, and so I'm glad it was in the same sermon, so I guess I can put them together here. Matthew 7 and verse 6. At some point, you may feel an obligation. Well, I always have to continue to try to say something. I always have to continue to try to... But it doesn't seem like it's going anywhere, and really it's just causing more and more pain coming back my direction. Well, verse 6, do not give what is holy to the dogs, nor cast your pearls before swine, lest they trample them under their feet and turn and tear you in pieces. At some point, God doesn't expect you to keep going to a terrible situation and keep raising I've got to try to teach with that particular situation. There is some point. Now, let's not take advantage of that and say, okay, I'm just never going to ever bring anything up to begin with. I don't think that's the point. But there's some point at which we need to rightly discern, this is not a relationship such that I have any more obligation to try to throw pearls here. Because God says, use some wisdom in whether or not to make that effort. There are times in which it will only bring you harm. There's not a requirement to keep going. And exacerbate that relationship and that problem. Cut ties, move on to where pearls are being thrown before people who would value it. You are not required to do something so much to your own harm for no potential benefit whatsoever. Exactly determining when a situation is at that point takes some wisdom and discernment, but there is a point there that will balance this concept. Think about the example from Paul. Romans 10. Who was it that was giving Paul more problems than anyone else? It was fellow Jews who would get upset at his teaching and preaching and cause all sorts of persecution. What was Paul's attitude toward his Jewish brethren? Brethren, my heart's desire and prayer to God for Israel is that they may be saved. His first goal was he wanted those, and even those who persecuted him like he used to persecute Christians, his desire was to try to help them to come to understand the truth and turn to it. And so he went to a lot of lengths and a lot of difficulties and a lot of harm to himself to give opportunity for them to learn the truth. But even with that, his desire being such, he didn't always feel the obligation in every circumstance to say something in a scenario which would have no fruit whatsoever and would only bring harm to himself. There's an interesting passage in Acts 22. Now, there were lots of times when he went ahead and said what needed to be said at the time. It wasn't well received, and he ended up bearing some consequence from it. But this one particular case, Acts 22, starting in verse 30. The next day, because he wanted to know for certain, the Roman commander, why Paul, was accused by the Jews, he released him from his bonds and commanded the chief priests and all their council to appear and brought Paul down and set him before them. Then Paul, looking earnestly at the council, said, "Men and brethren, I have lived in all good conscience before God until this day." And the high priest, Ananias, commanded those who stood by him to strike him on the mouth. Then Paul said to him, God will strike you, you whitewashed wall, for you sit to judge me according to the law, and do you command me to be struck contrary to the law? And those who stood by said, do you revile God's high priest? Then Paul said, I did not know, brethren, that he was the high priest, for it is written, you shall not speak evil of a ruler of your people. But when Paul perceived that one part were Sadducees and the other Pharisees, he cried out in the council, men and brethren, I am a Pharisee, the son of a Pharisee. Concerning the hope and resurrection of the dead, I am being judged. And when he had said this, a dissension arose between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and the assembly was divided. For Sadducees say that there is no resurrection and no angel or spirit, but the Pharisees confess both. Then there arose a loud outcry, and the scribes of the Pharisees' party arose and protested, saying, we find no evil in this man, but if a spirit or an angel has spoken to him, let us not fight against God. Now when there arose a great dissension, the commander, fearing lest Paul might be pulled to pieces by them, commanded the soldiers to go down and take him by force from among them and bring him into the barracks. This was an opportunity for Paul to talk to the Sanhedrin, and what did he do with the opportunity? Well, he turned it into a situation where the focus got off of him and he got out of the scenario, right? He didn't end up feeling an obligation to teach every last bit of the whole gospel in that context. That was a lose-lose situation. And he didn't waste an opportunity there. His desire is for them to be saved. But in this particular scenario, he determined to divide them, to quibble amongst themselves, was going to be the best scenario. Not, is he going to be able to address the Sanhedrin all gathered here to take him out? They had one purpose in mind. Is he going to be able to convince any one or a handful of the Sanhedrin of the truth at that point? All of those would end up staying aligned together no matter what individual might be thinking. They're all going to be unified in, you know, they're going to save face politically. It was not a scenario by which the teaching would have been effective to convert. And so he took a pass. And it was not in his best interest to force the issue to his own harm whenever there was no benefit to come from it. Don't throw pearls before swine. There were plenty of other times in which he took the heat of persecution because he gave it a shot. But not in this particular case. Matthew 21. Matthew 21. Do you ever get into a conversation and you feel like, well, I've got to answer every question somebody asks? And, you know, if they bring up whatever question and you think, wow, you know what, that's really not a beneficial thing for me to try to answer right now. I don't know that they're really ready for the answer to that particular question or whatnot, but you feel an obligation. Well, they ask a question, I've got to answer it immediately. Jesus didn't feel that way. And especially if someone's setting you up with hypotheticals only because they're trying to pepper you with questions and get at you and try to make you look in whatever way that they're wanting to reject, you don't have to answer that directly. Matthew 21, 23. Now when he came into the temple, the chief priests and the elders of the people confronted him as he was teaching and said, by what authority are you doing these things, and who gave you this authority? But Jesus answered and said to them, I also will ask you one thing, which if you tell me, I likewise will tell you by what authority I do these things. The baptism of John, where was it from? From heaven or from men? And they reasoned among themselves, saying, if we say from heaven, he will say to us, why then did you not believe him? But if we say from men, we fear the multitude, for all count John as a prophet. So they answered Jesus and said, we do not know. And he said to them, neither will I tell you by what authority I do these things. If someone is not genuinely interested in seeking the truth and they're simply trying to set you up, you are not obligated to fall for it. You need to investigate and give an opportunity to see whether or not they're interested in discussing truth. But if all they're doing is really just setting up a situation in order to set you up, you are not obligated to walk through that door. Because it would be throwing pearls before swine. Doing harm, no good, there's no benefit. Now, once again, there's got to be a lot of wisdom and a lot of discernment about when this would apply. But to always feel like you've got to give a full answer and to always feel like you've got to give a full defense in every circumstance is not true. And it can be harmful for no good purpose. John 7. Verse 1-14. I'll try to summarize a little bit of this, not read the whole thing. But verse 1, after these things, Jesus walked in Galilee, for he did not want to walk in Judea, because the Jews sought to kill him. And there's a feast coming up, and his brothers in the flesh start to egg him on and say, hey, you need to get on down to Jerusalem and just take things over and make a big deal. You know, if you're this big person that you claim you are, because why? Because even his own brothers didn't believe him at the time. Right? And so he answers and says, my time has not yet come, but your time is always ready. For the world cannot hate you, but it hates me because I testify of it that its works are evil. You go up to this feast. I'm not yet going up to this feast, for my time has not fully come. So he gives his brothers the impression, I'm not heading up there. When he had said these things to them, he remained in Galilee. But when his brothers had gone up, then he also went up to the feast, not openly, but as it were in secret. And so he ended up being at the feast, like he should have been. But he didn't go on terms that somebody else who meant him ill required or expected him to do. And so he didn't say, you know what, I am going to get up there or whatnot like that to give them. He gave them an impression, you go on and go, it's not time for me to go. And just didn't really feel an obligation to give any kind of an answer to them because they were intending harm. So he did go on his own terms. And at the appropriate time, he did step forward and speak while there, but not under the expectation or the scenario that the world was placing on him. We don't have to feel an obligation to go on the world's terms. We need to do what we're supposed to do, and we can do it on terms that are still pleasing to God, appropriate to the circumstance, rather than according to whatever our enemies might wish upon us. I think I want to talk about these in reverse order. They're right back to back here. 2 Timothy 2. Second Timothy 2:24-26. And a servant of the Lord must not quarrel, but be gentle to all, able to teach, patient, in humility, correcting those who are in opposition, if God perhaps will grant them repentance so that they may know the truth, and that they may come to their senses and escape the snare of the devil, having been taken captive by him to do his will. That's what we need to be about. We need to be about trying to reach and teach others patiently, carefully, lovingly. And yet look at verse 23. Right before this it says, "But avoid foolish and ignorant disputes, knowing that they generate strife." So there's some things to avoid, but always be in the mindset to try to help where it's possible to help. And I think that's the balance that we're looking for. We need to love others and seek opportunities to teach others, but to go into those scenarios with proper discernment, so that when we get to the point that continuing to proactively try to teach someone is no longer going to be received in any proper beneficial way whatsoever, then we just stop, we go to someone else. We look for other opportunities, and we don't have an obligation to keep beating that particular drum in that particular scenario. All right, well, these were the two ideas that I wanted to share with you tonight. The Christian's relationship with the world. We need to be in the world and engaged, but not be overly influenced such that we are worldly, that we are of the world. And we need to reach out and love and teach our friends and our enemies to try to do what's in their best interest. But there is a point at which we should cut ties if there's only harm and there's no good that would come from it. Those are the balanced, biblically balanced ways of dealing in our relationships with the world. If you will, go ahead and get your songbook out. Number 606. We will be singing this in just a minute. Tonight's lesson was about our relationship with the world. But we need to think, this is an opportunity at the end of the lesson for us to reflect on what is our relationship with Christ. Are we properly balanced in our relationship with Christ? Are we doing what we should be doing? Are we diligently seeking to be pleasing to God? If you're not a Christian, you are out of balance with God. You are needing to become a Christian. You are needing to put on Christ and start diligently seeking God. We would be glad to help you start down that path. If you are a Christian, but you've gone off onto one extreme or another, you've gone back toward worldliness and been overcome with it in some aspect or another, if there's some way that you need to make it right, if you need to make it right publicly, we invite you to come now as we stand and sing.